Chairman. Good morning. Stephen Mayne, shareholder. I'm a proxy representative for 9 other shareholders. I'm a candidate for the board. I've got a couple of questions to open up with. Just in relation to your speech this morning, I think it's fair to say that was a swashbuckling farewell.
Mr. Mayne, sorry, are these related to the financial reports, the director's report, or the auditor's report?
I've got a question about the general business, the general operation and management of the company, yeah.
Well, that question would seem to me to be best left until the end of the meeting when questions from shareholders will be received. I'm asking questions relating directly to item one on the agenda.
All right, Chairman. Well, normally general business is when you ask general questions. So I'm surprised that you're shunting the debate until the end of the meeting. Is that what you're proposing to do?
I'm asking for questions which relate to item one on the agenda paper. If you have a question relating to item one, would you please ask it?
All right. Well, in terms of the financial performance outline in the accounts, I'm concerned that we're going to seriously damage the financial performance as outlined in the accounts because of your attitude towards market supervision. I thought your performance today in blaming the press for everything was outrageous. And the facts of the matter are that the chairman of the Commonwealth Bank has criticised our market supervision performance, the chief executive of QBE has criticised it, and the debate has been led by Risk Metrics and Regnan, two prominent proxy advisory firms. And for the chairman of the ABC to stand up and blame the press for everything, I thought was just delusional.
Thank
and
you.
Completely disingenuous.
Do you have a question relating to the accounts, Mr. Mayne?
My question in relation to the accounts, Chairman, is how damaging will it be to our financial performance going forward if this board has so imperiled our monopoly franchise by its lacklustre supervision of the market that we are stripped of our monopoly and that we are stripped of our supervisory role? Because that's what I think you've done, and I think it's going to be enormously financially damaging to us. And to see you in complete denial, blaming the press for everything, I thought was outrageous. So how much will this cost us if we are stripped of the role?
Well, I think the question you ask, as you know, is rhetorical. But I think the premise on which you base your questions is that ASX has been negligent in relation to its supervision, and both I and the managing director have put before you facts which I think go to deny the points or the assertions that you make. Assertions don't mean facts. Assertions are what they are, and very often based in ignorance.
Jim, I haven't seen the actual financials. Could you tell us what the net assets of the fund are, and is there likely to be any call on the fund given the collapse of Opus and Shimura and Lift Capital and all the unprecedented chaos in the market over the last year? Will there be any calls, do you think, or has there been any claims on the fund as a result of those market mishaps?
Could I hand it over to General Counsel?
Thank you. Mr. Mayne, the net assets of the fund are in the order of $100 million. We have received two formal claims in relation to the fund from Opus Prime claimants. They are being considered and investigated. We are also on notice that there are likely to be other claims. The advice that we have is that the second creditors' meeting will now be held in mid-October, and we are expecting to have further clarification as we move towards that date as to the likely number of claimants and the heads of claim upon which they will be relying in relation to any claim on that fund.
Mr. Stephen Mayne, an external candidate, also seeks election to the board. As provided in the notice of meeting, the board unanimously believe that it is not in the best interests of ASX that Mr. Stephen Mayne be elected and recommend that shareholders vote against his election. The non-candidate directors do support Mr. Russell Abood and Mr. Trevor Rowe in their candidacy for re-election. Each candidate will address the meeting for up to 5 minutes before the discussion on their election. May I first introduce Mr. Stephen Mayne to address the meeting. I think there's a mic coming to you.
Thanks, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I've nominated for the board today, I guess out of frustration. I'm a shareholder in 730 different companies. I'm an investor in all of the different Babcock and Macquarie Bank listed investment vehicles. I should say I have very small shareholdings. The total value is less than 200,000. And I've suffered probably some of the worst performance, particularly from the Babcock and Brown vehicles. And in April this year, there was a very interesting report released by a firm called Risk Metrics, which explained how the governance procedures at these listed vehicles were really quite appalling. You know, they're often registered in Bermuda. They received waivers from the ASX in terms of the one vote, one value principle. You couldn't properly fire the board. The full management agreements weren't disclosed to the market. So I went along to the Macquarie Airport's AGM and I asked them to disclose the management contracts in full, because they'd been gouging.
Point of order. He's supposed to be telling us what he's all about, not about his losses and his gains. We want to know why we should vote for him.
Well, he knows you're a bad investor.
Would you like to get to the
I'd like to finish my 5 minutes, if that's all right, Chairman. Yeah. Macquarie Airport's refused to reveal the management agreement, even though they've literally taken many hundreds of millions in fees out of that vehicle. I then went to the Babcock and Brown annual meeting, and I asked them to release their management contracts there, and they refused. And I then went to the Macquarie Bank annual meeting, and I asked them to release their management contracts, and they refused as well. In the US, it's compulsory that you release your management agreements if you're a listed investment vehicle. So I decided to run for the board of the ASX on a very simple platform. That platform being that the ASX requires all third-party managed, externally managed investment vehicles to release their full management contracts. Very simple, and I undertook to resign as soon as the ASX did that. Now, I've been very disappointed that the ASX has released an advisory note or a practice note, and they've decided to encourage these listed investment vehicles to release their management contracts, but not to make it mandatory. So I guess I'm simply arguing for a good governance position that, particularly in this current credit crisis, I think there's been a disclosure failure has been contributed to that around the world, and I'm simply arguing for good disclosure, and that the ASX has lowered their corporate governance standards in order to maximise their listing fees and to encourage these vehicles to list on the Australian market. I think it's very disappointing that we have a Babcock and Brown director on our board. We also have a Macquarie Bank director on our board. And I think the ASX board is too captured by the issuers, by the brokers, and not represented enough by the investors who want maximum disclosure in the interest of investors. The situation with Babcock and Brown Power this year has been that they've ripped out more than $100 million in fees, and the whole company is only worth $100 million. And we can't sack the manager because they've got a 25-year management agreement that hasn't been disclosed. So it's a very simple message. Vote for me to put some pressure on the ASX to drive for better disclosure in the interests of investors, particularly as it relates to the various Babcock and Macquarie vehicles. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Main. We'll now discuss the election of Mr. Stephen Main. Is there any discussion on this resolution?
Zero 628, I think, is my number. Mr. Main has made a big song and dance about how much he's lost this year, but was he up talking last year?
Thank
the same
you.
People would have been controlling last year as well.
Thank you. Is there any are there any more questions?
I'll just respond to that, Chairman. Look, I ran for the board of the ASX.
Sorry, we're not. I'm asking for questions, Mr. May, not answers. That's all right. We've been criticised as well.
A couple of quick points, Chairman. John Jury, the Australian business commentator, made a reference to Trevor's quote myriad conflicts. In a column a few weeks ago. I'm just wondering if Trevor can address that issue as to whether he accepts that criticism. Does he have any conflicts that he thinks would be relevant to ASX shareholders? My other 2 points are, I think Trevor chairs 9 different bodies. He's the busiest man in Australia in terms of chairing 9 different bodies, somehow manages to sit on the Future Fund board and be chairman of the QIC. I would have thought that would be an obvious conflict of interest. But I guess to his time, he literally is the busiest chairman in the country. How does he have the time to perform his ASX duties, given all his other commitments? And as a shareholder in Bris Connections, who's in the Bris Connections share price is down 95%, and Trevor is the chairman, does Trevor believe that there is an amount of equity destruction or amount of percentage equity destruction in a company, in a listed company, that at some point would preclude someone from serving on the ASX board? In other words, how much can you blow up before you shouldn't be on the ASX board? In this case, I think it's about $350 million in a couple of months that's disappeared.
Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Main. Well, first of all, in terms of managing my time, I am conscious of how I manage my time effectively. I believe I do that, and I do that effectively. In terms of conflicts, obviously, business is all about managing conflicts, and I pay judicious attention to managing those conflicts. In terms of markets and their impact on companies, I don't control the markets nor where they will trade. I firmly believe that the companies I'm involved in, which are listed, which is United Group and Bris Connections, are in themselves very fine companies. Where they trade is another matter. I just should point out to you, though, on a fully paid basis, Bris Connections trades at a 35% discount, which is in the range for that particular sector, which I acknowledge is suffering with significant negative market sentiment at this time. Thank you.
Just a question on the decision to change auditor chairman. I understand that the chairman of our audit committee, Michael Sharp, has an office at PwC. We've made a decision to ditch KPMG and to appoint the firm at which he has an office. I think it would be appropriate that the full extent of the commercial relationship, if there is one, or if it's just a very small office relationship, that the full extent of that relationship be disclosed to the shareholders, given that we've decided to appoint PwC as our auditor.
Thank you, Mr. Main. What I will do is to refer that question to Mr. Rick Holliday-Smith, who chaired the committee, the selection committee of the auditors. So, Mr. Holliday-Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. The point that is raised is a valid point, and in discussions at audit committee, we reviewed at great length the issue of independence of the gentleman you're talking about, who was the chair of the audit committee, Michael Sharp. It was the view of the committee that given the long time between his past involvement with that company and today, it was not in our view an independence issue, although there might have been a perception that he did occasionally use an office in their office. It was decided as a matter of course that when we did the merge of SFE and ASX several years ago, a decision was made to put to tender the audit, and that was disclosed and was known to KPMG. It was decided that in any tender process all major firms would be invited, and that given there may be a perception in terms of the issue with PwC, that it was decided that Michael Sharp would have nothing to do with the review and tender process. And on that basis, I chaired a subcommittee, a special subcommittee, with two other directors. We invited all major firms, all main firms, to tender. We went through a rigorous tender process that took 3 months. We interviewed and discussed with all firms at extensive levels all the things that were required and all the issues. And in that process, I have to say, we had excellent candidates. It was a very difficult decision. And the committee, which did not in any way include Michael Sharp, in the end decided to recommend in a very difficult decision for us to move forward with PwC, and that was the process, and that was the final. That recommendation went to the board, and that recommendation was accepted by the board, and that is why we are where we are now. Not sure whether that answers your question. I'm happy to discuss it further if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Holliday-Smith. Does that answer your question, Mr. Main? I think just for the record, Mr. Sharp, you have not had an office at PwC for some years?
I did until 2007.
Yeah, thank you.
Chairman, a few weeks ago, Babcock & Brown announced that Mr. Sharp had resigned as a director due to health reasons. I don't want to pry into his health, but I'm curious as to how he can be healthy enough to continue serving on the ASX board, but not healthy enough to continue serving on the Babcock and Brown board.
Well, is that the end of your question?
That's my question, yes.
Thank you, yep. I'll ask Mr. Sharp to answer that directly, but I just wanted to reassure shareholders that that was a question that we asked as well, and we satisfied ourselves that Mr. Sharp's health is sufficiently robust for him to continue as an effective participating director. But Mr. Sharp.
Chairman, I'd just like to say in the difficult global economic conditions that existed this year, my responsibility at Babcock & Brown involved long hours, much overseas travel and considerable stress. Unfortunately, there were signs that my continuing in this role could have serious consequences for my health, and I was not prepared to risk this. I don't believe that my responsibilities at ASX cause a similar stress, because the responsibilities here are more like those of a non-executive director of most large public companies, and I look forward to continuing as a director of ASX, and recent medical advice confirms that there appears to be no reason why I should not do so.
Thank you.
Chairman, I just want to check your swashbuckling chairman's address of blaming the press for everything and ignoring the comments by QBE, Combank, Regnan, Risk Metrics, and various other people. Was that endorsed by the board, the full board, that speech?
The board endorses my comments. Yes, it does.
But did you run the text of the speech past the full board for full board approval?
Yes, I did, Mr. Main.
And Mr. Gonski personally endorses all of those sentiments as the new chairman?
Mr. Main, I do. I think, though, that you are making quite a lot out of what was said. I think that what the chairman said very clearly to the meeting is that we believe that we've had very high standards in what we've done, and that a lot has been said of us that is incorrect. And he actually, to his credit, went through a number of different allegations and showed what they were. I understand your frustration, but I also do not in any way suggest that the chairman, be he chairman of the ABC or this company, was suggesting that the press is all bad. That is not what he was saying, and that is certainly not what this board nor he believes. There have been suggestions in the press, there have been suggestions by other parties, and we are proud of what our people have done. It's very hard for them to do what they do and to keep reading negative things about themselves which are not warranted. And I think as a board we will continue to take that stand. Having said that, if the press are quite entitled to make their views, and if we do err, then we must be corrected.
Can I just like Morris to acknowledge a couple of points? Basically, the tone of what you were saying, Morris, was we've done nothing wrong. It's all the press's fault. That was the way I interpreted it. And I'd just like to ask you, do you now accept in hindsight that the waiver you gave to AWB, where it fundamentally ignored the one vote, one value principle, was wrong? Do you acknowledge that the 25-year management contracts given to Babcock and Brown Power were wrong? And do you also finally acknowledge that, I mean, I ran for the board in 2000, 2001, 2002 on a platform that you had a conflict of interest. You're now saying you have no conflict of interest because you have complete separation. So are you tacitly admitting then, Chairman, that when you were chairman yourself of the market supervision separate company, and when Michael Sharp was still sitting on the board, you now admit that was wrong and that there was a conflict of interest. So you can't say there was no conflict back then if you're now saying, because we have complete separation, there is now no conflict. So do you acknowledge you erred when you first set up that separate body by not having it separate enough and independent enough, and that Mr. Gonski's got it right by not going on that board, whereas your decision was to chair the Market Supervision Board?
Well, that's a lot to respond to, but let me say first of all, no, it was not a mistake to establish ASX market supervision in the way that it was, and in the case of myself as being the first chair of ASXMS, I had no external boards that would conflict with my role as a chairman of the market supervision area. So it was not a mistake, and what we have done is to evolve a structure which goes much more to perceptions than it does to the reality of the way in which ASX-MS operates. Could I say in relation to decisions in relation to AWB, which I don't recall, but Mr. Main, this other Mr. Main, Eric Main, our chief executive of the market supervision area, he may be able to add some light to AWB, but what I can say in relation to the infrastructure companies that you refer to, it was implicit that investors in those companies or those entities wanted to know and have the comfort that managers would be there for long-term infrastructure investments in order that they would be able to apply their expertise. The information that was necessary for investors to decide whether they wanted to invest in a company that had a long-term management agreement or not was made available in the prospectus. And so you had a choice. If you didn't like the basic 10-point disclosure that was in the prospectus, then you would not have invested. And I think to lay the blame or to move to laying the blame on ASX for investment decisions that have gone wrong because there wasn't sufficient disclosure, I think is not being reasonable at all. So, if you'd like Mr. Main to say something about AWB,
Yes, please,
Mr. Main.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Main, no relation, but we share a common spelling of our surname.
Thanks, bro.
The AWB matter, it certainly preceded my time as the appointment of Head of Supervision, but in terms of the issue around special classes of shares being issued to organisations like AWB and organisations in the stapled securities, listed entities in and around organisations like Babcock and Brown, or whether it be also Macquarie, those companies that you've adverted to, those waivers that are granted in relation to those shares essentially to seek to align the interests of the people that are operating the business of the company under management agreements or the like, and also the actual owners of the company and also the shareholders and the board. So seeking to align those interests for a period of time. In the AWB case, my understanding is that they're moving towards a segregation and separation back to a normalised organisation. And in relation to the types of structures for Babcock and Brown and also for Macquarie Group that have these responsible entity trust manager with a management agreement and a company, a staple security, there is an ability for the staple security holders to remove the responsible entity by an ordinary shareholder resolution, and in which case it can be, on the occurrence of that event, the special class of shares which are there to assure the alignment of interests over the period of the contract, they then dissolve at that point in time.
But you've got to keep paying them for 25 years. It's not really much good to sack them when you've got to keep paying them. They're unsackable, in effect.
That's what is left in place is the management agreement, and that's the terms in which that management agreement operated, which would have been disclosed at the time of the initial listing as a material contract in the prospectus, and there would have been disclosure to shareholders at that point in time. Yes, there was a commercial agreement in place, and yes, there would be termination rights in relation to that, which would have been disclosed to shareholders in accordance with the disclosure obligation under the Corporations Act. And to my mind, it's just like an ordinary commercial agreement which is subject to termination rights.
That's my whole point. They haven't been disclosed. I was running for the board on a platform that the contracts be disclosed. You just said they're disclosed. They're not disclosed.
No,
that's the whole point.
The relevant terms of the contract are being disclosed under the prospectus, and that's the obligation that's required under the Corporations Act. We put out a recent guidance note which encourages companies, if they want to disclose the full agreement. We've also provided 10 essential terms that need to be disclosed. In looking at this whole point, one needs to balance the interests of the shareholders, the interests of the listed company in terms of what is a full and appropriate disclosure that's being made to shareholders. The decision could be, do we disclose the full agreement and have no summary around no explanation as to what is actually in that agreement, what are the main provisions, or do we have a system where we disclose or require disclosure of the 10 essential terms if we put it to them, and at the same time encourage companies, if they want to disclose to the shareholder the full agreement, and indeed if the shareholders ask them that they'd like to have a copy of that agreement, for the company to provide a copy to the shareholders who request it.
I guess my point is that you require disclosure of the full constitutions of companies. The listing rules force full disclosure of constitutions, and I'm simply asking that the listing rules should also force full disclosure of management contracts, as happens in the US.
Could I suggest that perhaps this is getting a rather arcane discussion, that the two Mr. Maines, if they are so inclined, take this discussion offline?
Last couple, Chairman. Was ASX in the tent on Sunday leading up to ASIC's remarkable announcement? It was just incredible to have a junior minister in a new government announcing something that was so revolutionary. Can you take us through what happened on Sunday? There are some conspiracy theorists who look at it and say, well, Tony D'Aloisio was fired as the ASX CEO with a $7.7 million payout when the shareholders forced Robert Elston on the board, and that there's some ongoing bad blood there, and that there's an element of get square going on where D'Aloisio is acting unilaterally away from the ASX, leading to that extraordinary decision on Sunday night in what looks like a grab for the regulatory role. So I think it's fair enough, given all of that, for you to tell us exactly whether you were in the tent, whether you endorsed what was announced on Sunday night, given that it led to the one-hour delay in trading.
Would you like to answer the question of...
As I won't respond on the in-the-tent part of your question, Stephen. I don't think it would be appropriate other than to give you a level of satisfaction that over, really from Friday morning, when we were initially contacted by ASIC, we had already seen moves from the Securities Exchange Commission in the US and from the Financial Services Authority in the UK in those two jurisdictions. We had already read that clearly global regulators led out of the US and out of the UK were coordinating a worldwide action. Other countries have followed, France, Germany, and others in recent days. So we were well aware before we were contacted by ASIC Friday morning that there was a very high likelihood that ASIC would wish to fall into line partially, fully, or go even further than those other Northern Hemisphere regulators. We were contacted appropriately by ASIC Friday morning, and there was a deal of conversation between the exchange and ASIC. It was never going to be the exchange's decision. And I think it goes to responses that Morris and I have given on other questions. We are not the market regulator. This decision was made by the market regulator as part of a coordinated global response. There was a high degree of consultation with the exchange, with broker-dealer participants, but I think it's fair to say it was always going to be a regulatory decision made by the corporate regulator. But I think there was a great deal of dialogue over the weekend between all the various parties. As the market operator, which we are, our primary concern is that under the umbrella of any regulatory framework, our obligation is to make sure that we operate the market in as orderly a fashion as we can. With such a profound prohibition being introduced so quickly, there was a frantic level of activity over the weekend to try and minimise uncertainty in the market on the open. That was one of the reasons why we delayed for an hour to get further clarifying statements out of ASIC, which have been in two or three tranches over the first two trading days. I'm not going to comment on the conspiracy theory. I think it's the stuff of Hollywood movies, and I don't think I would proffer any comment on the early part of your question.
And my last question is, it might be another example of outrageously inaccurate reporting, but Mr. Gonski has been linked as the advisor to Frank Lowy on the whole Liechtenstein thing, which has led to poor Peter Lowy having to plead the fifth in the US, which is a pretty sort of dramatic situation. So I think he's fair enough, given the importance of the ASX role. It's a preeminent position of reputation and trust, that Mr. Gonski enlightens us as to whether this was indeed another case of outrageously inaccurate reporting, that he was involved in any of this.
Chairman, I think I'm the only one who can really respond to Mr. Main's question on that. Firstly, Mr. Main, I would say it's, when we're talking about the affairs of somebody else, I don't feel I should comment on it, and nor would it be right for us to do that. But let me talk about myself. I think really the only person who's been saying that I'm linked with what's been going on is in fact yourself. There was in a number of newspapers a comment that I was at a meeting. That may or may not be the case. It's not the place to negotiate it. But it was basically never suggested that I did advise on those things, nor that there were things. So it's again a little bit of a trump-up. Having said that, I believe I stand on my own record. I have been an advisor to many people over many years. I'm proud of what they and I have done. Having said that, I also feel that I can take on this role as chairman and would be delighted to do so and look forward to it. And I assure you, the shareholders, that I would try, and it will be very hard, I know, to keep up the high standards of what have been set in this company.
Thank you, Mr. Gonski.
My name is Gavin Wilcox. I'm a former member of the Sydney Stock Exchange Committee and ASX Sydney Committees. And I have known Morris, I think, for the 50 years plus he has been involved with the Stock Exchange. Morris, I don't have a question, but I think I'm right in saying that you are the last local exchange member to be on the ASX board. You have given us 14 years of chairmanship, before that some years on the board, and before that many years of service to the Sydney Stock Exchange, ASX Sydney and the Sydney Stock Exchange. As well as being on many, many committees involved with the exchange, you're also involved in a lot of other areas. I just feel, having known you this long, I would like to say thank you very much for the work you have done and the time you have put in looking after the interest of the Sydney Stock Exchange, ASX Sydney and the ASX board. Thank you, Murray.
Thank you. Thank you.